First, tell me a bit about yourself. How did you come to work for the Reading Tellers?
Let's see. When I was in the Marine Corps, I had about 6 months ago, before I was discharged, I was working on a comic strip called Wally the Bomb. And I came home on leave, brought that strip in to show to Gensler, who was the Times cartoonist at that time, for the Writing Times. And he gave me a couple instructions how to correct this thing, you know, and how to improve the strip. So I buzzed back to the Marine Corps, and before I could get my discharge, I had to go through a hernia operation, which meant I couldn't work when I got out, which was agreeable to me, but still, you were out of employment. And I used that time then to work on this comic strip, and at that particular time, they moved Gensler from the Times up to the Eagle, and he had remembered my strip, and then got a hold of me. And by dumb luck, for once in my life, I had worked, you know, actually completed an art project, which pleased him, and then he asked me if I wanted to come in here, which I did. And in a way, it was a good break, but put you in a rut. It would be much better to go to school like you're going than to come into a one-slot job. You're going to get an overall background, where I was just doing, you know, the same type of thing year after year. And after about 10 years of this type of thing, you realize how slotted you are. And the outfit, no matter where you go, knows you don't have art school or college. They got you. They aren't giving you the money they should, because they figure you don't have the educational background to move on. So at that point, then I went up to Kutztown, picked up my degree, and things have, you know, changed for the better since then, just picking up the degree. There's the other drawback about working for a newspaper that I find, as far as comic work goes, you don't have any particular character. You have to draw everything as far as general figures. And after a while, you get sort of a nondescript man and woman representing humanity. It's strange. And all your men start to look alike, except for maybe one has black hair, one has blonde hair, and your women get the same way. And your children are sort of generalized. In other words, you're not really going for one specific character. And while your humor and everything is specific, your real character, individual characteristics are not coming out like they should. To me, this is where someone like Jim Stranko has a big advantage over anyone working, you know, like here at a newspaper, because Jim can really take a character and go into all its qualities, good, bad, and indifferent. He has a much wider range than we do in here. We have too many editors sitting on our backs that say no and this and that, and we have to watch color, we have to watch religion, all kind of crap that while Jim has to watch it, he doesn't have to be as careful as we do. So it's much more advantageous to work on a comic strip like Jim does, or, you know, anything in that line, rather than this general stuff here. And editorially, it's all this crap about the newspaper, you know, freedom of the press and so forth, that's all a bunch of jazz, because when you get down to it, the company is still owned by either a group or an individual. And if they're Republican, they have Republican viewpoints. And if they're Democrat, they have Democratic viewpoints. So it's just another business. And you're really limited in what you can, the ideas that you can project. You're virtually told what to do constantly, which, you know, sort of gets to you after a bit. So Jim's been pretty lucky that he's over on the other side of the fence, I think so.
Okay, well, how did you meet Jim?
Jim, of course, I was in here about 5 years, and Jim came in like many young artists do. We might get, say, 5 or 6 kids a year. And Jim just popped into the art room, and fortunately, both of us were there. I'm the literally the night man. I work for the morning newspaper. The other chap who works for the afternoon paper normally would leave about 4 or 5 o'clock. Jim popped in late afternoon, caught both of us, and just showed us this fantastic artwork, which knocked us both off our heels. And here's this kid about 15 years old asking us what we might suggest to improve his work, and his work was already so far ahead of ours that, you know, it was just pathetic, actually. And it's a thrill to see someone with that much talent come in. And I think, as I recall, Gensler, the older artist, suggested a little more shadow work and stuff like that. The work that Jim showed us was oil paintings of faces and figures and things like that. Very dramatic, very strong. He was getting a real strong feel of action even at that point. You were just astounded by the quality of the work. You know this fellow hasn't been published. You know he is going to be published. And you have a strong idea that he's going to be a big name, which of course he is today. When Jim came in, at that time long hair wasn't in. And Jim, of course, was really already spaced at that time. Beautiful long hair, you know. And he was dressed completely in black. Had a black leather jacket, real tight black trousers and black boots. Good old mysterious black Jim came in, you know. I think it was the second time he popped back in. Gensler wasn't in at that time. It was just myself. I was talking to Jim. And this editor walked by, who at that time was our city editor, and is now our managing editor, unfortunately. This joker sticks his head in, and he sort of just looks at Jim in shock, and this is Mr. Straight himself. Today, he still has a crew cut, you know, and the whole routine. Sometime later that evening, he calls me back in his office and says, who was that joker in your room? I told him, young fella has some really great artwork, and, you know, we're working together on it. He says, don't let him in the building anymore. He says, I don't want a guy dressed like a bum in our building. So when Jim came in the next time, I said, hey, we either have to close the door or hide you. We have an uptight guy in here that doesn't appreciate the way you dress. Jim really at that time was too far out to go into any art place around here. You could do it in New York with no sweat, or Philadelphia, but around here, you know, you couldn't walk into Bowman Hill or Sterling or anything like that. So I said, look, Jim, dressing in black's fine, but take off the leather jacket and, you know, just break it down a little bit. You don't shake these guys like the editor that disapproves of this. You can go in with your portfolio and let your work speak for yourself. You don't have to be that dramatic, actually, because Jim is literally still on stage wherever he went, and this is the way he is still today. The next time he popped in, he had a black sport coat on, a black turtleneck, and black pants, but he looked sharp, you know? And I think the thing that offended this joker at that time was the black motorcycle jacket, because this somehow threatened him. So I used to sneak Jim in, you know. He'd come up and we'd just go to the back portion of the room. And if we hear this guy lumbering around, he's pretty loud in his voice, you could tell he was around, or we just kept quiet till the guy got out of sight. So this is the way we handle it. So.
Did Jim cut his hair?
No, he didn't. Because this was part of his stage presentation at that time. I think he was in his rock group at that point. There was no reason for him to really over-adjust for someone who wasn't going to employ him, or, you know, just casually made a comment like that. When he went up to work at his first job, which was at Rick's Printing on, I think that was Pear Street at that time. They're now over in West Reading. And Jim was hired at $2.50 an hour as their artist. He worked there like 2 years. Then, of course, Jim modified his dress somewhat there, which is one of those things.
You know Mr. Post?
Yeah.
Steve Post?
Yeah.
He owns Rick's Printing.
Yeah, right. And of course, Jim is still a very good friend of Post. Still does occasionally, I think, emergency job or something like that, from what I hear, if Post really gets in a jam.
What kind of artwork did Jim do for them at that time?
Mostly just more straight layout for flyers, anything that had to be printed. He'd do type layouts, occasional illustrations, anything in just the general printing line. It was just a small print shop at that point. And the interesting part to me was that Jim already had enough savvy at that point to smell the buck. He knew he was only obviously getting $2.50 an hour. And somehow he found out that Post, or whoever had charge of this outfit, was charging $5 an hour for the artwork. So, of course, then Jim made the approach for more money. He wanted more of the share of the profit there, and was turned down, as I recall. I'm not quite sure about that. There was some kind of hassle there. Then the next thing I knew, he was over using the space with Minker. He had some kind of arrangement that he had space at Minker's. He would do X amount of jobs for Minker. Now, whether they were jobbed over to him or not, I don't know. But,
did he go directly from Rick's printing to Minker?
Yeah, as I recall. Now, this is quite a while back.
I understood he was a sign painter, graphic designer.
Well, he covered quite a bit of this at Rick's, you know, that type of thing. Now, he might have been continuing this. My recollection is that he went right over to Minker, you know, which was a much, much better deal. And he really got into some nice, heavy stuff at that point. And then, instead of just screwing off during his lulls, you know, in Venice, he really went into some good cartoon-type illustration, comic work. And that's where he got started over there, in the illustration of the comics.
What was your reaction when he got into the comics?
His work is, it was just so superior that my reaction was that I was really curious whether he could crack the market or not. I really was. And because, you know, you hear all these stories of guys that go up to New York with great artwork and stuff and come back disappointed and so forth. And then after about 2 years at Minker's, he worked up a series of fantastic drawings, about 18 inches high. I don't know if you've seen them or not. They were on, like, he had, like, Huns, these warriors of the past with fur and big swords. And Attila the Hun and all that stuff, you know. They weren't copies, they were his own characters. And he had these nice, big, beautiful, fresh-looking drawings in brush. And he finished them, he colored them in, and he told me, he said, I'm going to take these up to New York and see what happens. And those are the drawings that got him in to the comic business. They were really, really fantastic. He had some good, sexy-looking babes there, and as only Jim can draw.
I heard the story different, that he took in a pencil 20-page comic strip of Super Agent X.
Maybe he did, now.
Maybe he took both.
Yeah, now maybe he took both. It might have been a combination. As far as I know, those were the drawings that he told me he was going to take to New York and, you know, just make the rounds to see if there was any possibility, what his talent was and so forth. I didn't see any pencil thing that was Secret Agent. Well, according to that, then, he would have had to come with the character, Secret Agent X.
He created it.
That was his creation, then. Maybe that's it. But if he created it, that would still be his comic strip, wouldn't it?
He was willing to let it be the property of the comic book company with the agreement that he would do it for them, but that never came about. So it's still his property.
It still is his property, then.
There was almost a Paramount animated cartoon with it.
Yeah. So it's a wonder he doesn't publish now, you know, with his own publishing.
I think he will in a portfolio.
Yeah.
You mentioned the rock group he was in. Tell me what you know about that.
Well, he played down at the Spartacos, and to me, it sounded good, you know. My wife and I were down there, and a whole gang of us, and of course Jim's up there coordinating on the stage. He's really getting into it, you know, really bending down with the guitar and stuff, and stomping his feet, and then he'd go into a little foot shuffle bit. You know how you really get into the thing. We were having a ball, but years later, I ran into a guy that was pretty strong into the music world, at least in this section. And he knew Jim, of course, and I asked him his opinion of Jim's musical ability. And he said, as good as he is in art, he's that bad in rock. Or he was that bad at that time. And this could be true. I wouldn't be a good judge of it. His music sounded good to my ear, but I trained ear, of course, to judge. He didn't stay in it too long.
I understood 10 years.
I don't think it was in that long.
That's what I read. I'll have to look up.
Yeah, check on that if you get a chance.
Well,
Jim,
what was the name of the group that he was with that you saw?
His brother was still playing the Spadesman, I think it was. I think. I'm not sure.
Steve?
Yeah, Steve. Is Steve still playing with them?
I have no idea.
He was for a while. from what I can remember, I think Steve had a little more musical talent than Jim did, but Steve has nothing in the other line. And Steve today is, he's repairing electric shavers for Norelco. Goes around to different stores and you take your shaver in and I'll clean it up for you. Which, he has his own franchise there, so he's doing okay. But I was talking to Steve about Jim, and, this was down at Bosco's. And this was about, I'd say 8 months ago. And I was telling him, of course, I knew Jim and so forth. And you get the feeling that there's a pretty strong bond between the two, but there hasn't been that much communication in the last couple of years. You know, Steve didn't seem to know too much about what Jim was doing.
I think I know more about what Jim's doing than he does.
Yeah, I would go along with this. And I remember mentioning a few things, whatever they were, to Steve, that it was news to Steve that Jim had done these things. Now, of course, this could be just two brothers taking off in two different directions, you know, and one doesn't care about the other till later in life, and then you come back and search one another out, or whatever.
You say that was a month ago you talked to
him? No, that was about 8 months ago.
8 months.
Yeah. I remember one incident. We were up at Lake George, which is up in New York State, on vacation, my wife and my daughter and myself. And a couple miles below Lake George, there's a little frontier town with kiddie rides and so forth, and we took our daughter down to this place, and they had a little vaudeville show with a couple acts, one of which was a magician's act, and two young magicians were doing things. They were cutting up a carrot and cool, and the carrot then would become whole, and different little tricks like that. Nothing super fantastic. Just on a lark after the show, since their act was last, and they were just cleaning up the stage there, I walked over, and I had no idea how famous Jim was, at least in the magic world at that time. And of course, he hadn't broken into the cartoon, the comic world. But I walked up, and I started chat with these guys and telling them that this friend of mine is also a magician. And of course, they're sort of like kidding me about this thing. Yeah, what's your friend's name and so forth. And I mentioned the name Jim Steranko. And both their mouths open up, you know, in stunned disbelief. And the one chap sent his buddy back to the their dressing room to get a magic magazine. He says, go back and get volume 10 or edition 4 or whatever. And this guy comes running back with this magic mag, and here Jim's picture, he's on the front cover. And I was just as flabbergasted at that point. And these two guys are all excited because they want to know how well I know him, where he lives, what kind of pad he lives in, and what he eats, what he wears, and all this stuff. And I tried to give him crazy an answer as I could in reply to all this stuff, to sort of do it the way Jim would do it, or the way I thought he would want it done. I described his pad as something really fantastic. At that time, aluminum wasn't in or anything. I said he had aluminum sheets for wallpaper, and a big gong that instead of a doorbell. I was going through all kind of crap, you know. And his eating habits, of course, at midnight was the only time he ever ate, and things like this. He only drank certain juices. I said he had a black magic room that he let no one in, and all kind of crap, whatever I could think of, which was, of course, strictly art. And I remember coming back running then, of course, giving Jim a call about this. And some of the commercialism of Jim at that point came out. He was more interested in what I told him than who the guys were, which was, you know, sort of a little revelation there. As Jim didn't give a shit about the guys themselves, who really were interested in Jim. His only interest was that the legend, no matter how much it had been exploited, was continued, which was, to me, an interesting insight, that Jim was strictly interested in this sort of stage projection type thing. And he could care less about the two guys who were interested. They were just two more fans at that point.
Tell me about his rabbit.
One night I went up to his apartment, which at that time was down on South 5th Street, third floor. And he had this apartment laid out as exotic as he possibly could. And I didn't know he had this damn rabbit in his apartment. Now I'm standing there talking to him in the living room, and I feel this nibbling at my pants cuff. And Jim of course, knew the Rebbe was there. I didn't know what the hell was down there, and I didn't know what the hell he had in his apartment, you know, because this whole thing is real, like, weird at that time. And I didn't want to, you know, show I was over-concerned about him. You know, I was trying to play this thing real cool, but he saw me trying to glance down, and of course he said, that's just Harry, my Belgium hair, whatever the name of it was. I looked down, and here's this rabbit with these huge ears down there, real friendly little thing, so he was putting around there for a little while. He said that he had a little cage, as I recall, in the bathroom, because this rabbit would get it out, and he said he has no respect for culture. And he, Jim, as you know, has this collection of valuable books and all kind of drawings and stuff. And this little rabbit would, if a corner of a drawing was sticking out, he'd chew it. He says, and then he went on to explain some, tell me about some of the books this rabbit has destroyed and stuff like that. It's interesting because I don't think Jim would tolerate that from, like, a woman. You know, if a girl or something he was dating would destroy something of his, I'm convinced he would get rid of her. That would be the end. But this rabbit was, like, getting away with murder. So it was sort of a humane quality of Jim that sort of snuck out there. I don't want to infer that he's not human, because he certainly is. But there's many aspects where Jim's a little chum.
The rabbit is not responsible for it. But human being would know what it was doing if it destroyed something, would be purposeful.
It's strange. He just seems a little more impatient with people than with animals, or at least with that particular animal. I can remember, too, one time, he gave me a call, he says, I went up to New York, and it just happened I was that particular weekend. And he said, can I go along? I said, sure. His car was in a shop or something like that, and at that time he had a big Cadillac. He's going up to New York with us, and he's telling me about, he's supposed to design the sets for this French movie director. It was supposed to be a movie on de Sade. They had made a movie on the Marquis de Sade before. I think it was an English movie. And the French were up in arms because this wasn't the true depiction of de Sade. And de Sade, of course, was a Frenchman. And now they wanted to bring out a more true-to-life version of this particular man. And Jim had received this call from France. And this fellow had asked him if he'd be interested in designing the sets. And he was going, said he was going up to New York to see this guy. This was a little too much for me, a guy from Reading, you know. Is he putting me on, you know? Well, so what if he is? That's his business. So we get up around, I think it was 37th Street or 38th, somewhere in there. And we buzz over to 6th Avenue or 5th or someplace. He said, this is the spot, drop me off. Which I did, and we had agreed that in 1 or 2 days, when we were ready to leave that Sunday, I was to call a number he had given me and check with him whether he's ready to go back. So, of course, we go through our weekend and so forth, and I call this number, and this real French-sounding female answers. You know, she says, Monsieur this and Monsieur that, and I ask for Jim, and she says, certainly, she says, just one moment, you know, and it was no put-on. I'm standing there completely stunned, because I knew then that he was really, you know, into this whole thing. So we picked him up down at some corner close to there, to where we had dropped him off. And he's telling us about all this fantastic weekend he had with this director, how they're going through all the possibilities of different things they could do, different effects and so forth, and that it would take about 6 months. This guy had to go back to France and also over to England to set up financing and so forth. And Jim would know in 6 months whether he had the job or not. And of course, then would have to go over to Europe to, you know, set up this whole arrangement. But the thing, unfortunately, never came off. But it's interesting that Jim was selected to do this. Quite an honor just to be selected, I think.
When was it?
It was, I'd say, about 2 years ago.
I recall him telling me about that.
Yeah, do you remember that? Yeah.
Yeah, he said he was waiting for a telegram to go to Europe.
Yeah, right. That would have been it.
But it never came.
Never? Yeah, right. Because I checked with him later, and I forget what whether the guy couldn't get money or there was some kind of hassle, you know, and the whole thing was sort of abandoned. It was really exciting just to know someone that was already operating on actually an international scale at that point.